Welcome to the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Here are your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub.
All right, welcome to Legally Sound Smart Business episode
number 3.
This is Nasser Pasha and
I'm Matt Staub.
Very cool. Well, thanks for listening to our podcast again. Also submitting your questions to ask at Legally Sound Smart Business. Keep sending them in. And don't forget to tell us what kind of business you're in and where you're located to help us answer some of your questions. So this is a weekly podcast and we cover business-related news and the law and also answer your business legal-related questions. So let's get started, Matt.
All right. First thing up today, it's an article about company culture saying 80% of companies don't care about company culture, do you? It's a longer article and it details this position of a design executive officer, or DEO, which prior to reading this, I had never heard of. And I still, after reading, I'm not sure it's a real position, but
I'm pretty sure the person that wrote this article was a DEO and also the first DEO known in existence.
The article is good though, because it goes in details about does company culture matter? And it talks about Tom's, for example, with the way they do some donations, the one-for-one sort of thing that they do. But what do you think about company culture?
You know, company culture, I agree with the premise that I think most companies don't care. I think a lot of the bigger size companies use their company culture as a recruiting tool or something to develop publicity for. But I see that one of the first questions the DEO asks is, what's your purpose of forming your ideal company culture? They may have different reasons, but for me, when we talk to our clients, I think about risk management.
You're saying about when should they care? You said you agree with kind of the premise of the article, but that 20%, who is that 20%?
Well, it probably should be more. We always have those clients, Matt, that no matter what, they're always going to get in trouble. And that may be good for us because they need our help and so forth. But isn't it true that there's certain clients that the CEO is just a certain type of personality and they create a certain environment for them that they're always going to get into business disputes. They're always going to get sued by their employees. And look, you know, employment law is tough. It's very easy to make even the smallest mistake, but not everyone gets in trouble for it. We have a set of clients that they're not perfect and they make mistakes, but they never get sued from their employees. Whereas we have a clients that doesn't seem to stop. And every month, something else, they're getting accused for sexual harassment, even if they didn't do it or not. Or in the next week, they're getting in some dispute with one of their contractors and getting sued on that. They want to send out a demand letter. And to me, that's corporate culture. That's the difference between whether or not you are dispute heavy and going to get into trouble versus more trying to resolve the issue and do business the way that you want.
Right. So you think the people are the most important part of this?
Yeah, I think so. CEOs, management level. I don't know. I mean, how do you devise a corporate culture from scratch? At the end of the day, it comes down to people. I mean, this DEO talks about, assuming they're the ones that wrote this article, they talk about not only just people, but environment, ambiance, and how corporate culture changes over time. But it seems very difficult, unless you hire a DEO, apparently, to really craft your corporate culture without removing the essence of the person in there.
Right. I agree. And I think it starts from the top down. So if you have your executives, they're kind of the leaders, maybe not the DEO since it's a fake position, but the other executives, you know, they kind of set the pace and they're the example. And then it flows throughout the entire company. If they're doing the right things and making the right decisions, then I think it'll flow through to everyone. I mean, you're going to always have those trouble employees, but for the most part, you should be able to get around that just by setting the example up top and having it trickle down through everyone in the company.
Well, check this out. An employee handbook may document the ideals, but the culture is reinforced without a rule book.
Yeah, I like it.
This is actually a pretty good point because we draft employee handbooks all the time, you know, 50 pages or whatever. Do any of them really follow it? Do these employers even know what's in it? And so I think culture is more than just setting up a set of rules, but it's the heart of the matter.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. That's a good sentence from that. I mean, I'm trying to think of past jobs I had when I was younger. I know they gave us in high school, I'm not going to read anything that's the handbook. You know, I work for a big chain restaurant. They give me all these details. There's no way I was going to read through that stuff.
Yeah. Everyone remembers if they've had a good boss or a bad boss.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with what's in a company rule book. You could have the best boss in the world and a horrible handbook or vice versa, and it's not going to make a difference.
Right. I agree completely. Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Let's go to our first question. This is from Texas, right?
Yeah, and it relates to what we were just talking about. So question one, anonymous person. So they wanted to remain anonymous from Texas.
You didn't want to tell us the type of business even?
I'm not sure if I even see it on here.
Okay, well, he wants to be remain really anonymous. So let's see what he says.
Okay. Dear Mr. Pasha and Mr. Staub, I have an employee who registered a similar, shorter domain name of our company in his own name. He mentioned it to me after the fact, but it didn't really seem important to us at the time. We switched to new servers last week, and we wanted to use the shorter domain for our email addresses, but our employee, who is our IT manager, has kept it under his own name personally. We've been considering replacing him for a little bit, but I'm worried that if we terminate him, he'll try to extort the domain name, and we'll lose the domain name completely. What should we do? Signed, Anonymous.
Signed Anonymous. Probably it's the hacker group, I think, Anonymous.
Yeah.
Well, this is a pretty good question, actually.
Yeah.
We come across this from different perspectives all the time, not just from employees, right? Sometimes this occurs when you hire a marketing company or some other consultants and so forth.
Yeah.
Who owns your domain name? Even competitors, right?
Competitors too, yeah. That came to mind.
You're right. This does kind of relate to our corporate culture because, okay, here you have a dispute, so-called, with your employee. Now, how are you going to deal with it? You could probably strong arm him, and we can talk about the law here in a second and force him to give over the domain name, but is that really going to get to your goal as efficiently as possible? Are you going to create more of a mess than you really need to? Those are some of the questions you need to ask first, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the first thing that I would deal with then is trademark, right? If you've established your trademark as, I assume the domain name is similar to your company name or some other mark that you're using, then that may be a basis to solidify your ownership over the domain name. Also, there's something called domain squatting. And if they've registered the domain name in bad faith and are not really using it or something to that effect, then that might be a recourse for you. But I think the most important aspect is the fact that the domain name was purchased by the employee in the scope of his employment during the time where he's an employee. And there's different ways to deal with this. Have any ideas, Matt?
Yeah, that's what I just can't get over is I want to know why this employee even purchased this shorter domain name to begin with. What were the motives behind this? If I was this person's boss, I would just ask him straight up. I don't understand why you even bought this in the first place.
That's true. He didn't tell us why.
That would be the starting point for me. And then based on what he or she said to me back, that's when I would get into what we needed to do, whether it be terminate them or maybe it's not as bad as it thinks, and you can just be like, hey, you know, we want to buy this from you. We'll reimburse you.
Oh, you think that the employee bought it for bad intentions, possibly?
It's a thought that popped in my head. You know, sometimes you're working for somebody. I mean, I run into this all the time. You see people working for somebody. They sit there. They watch the day-to-day operations. They think they can do the job better. So they start collecting information, and eventually they just leave and try to start their own company, essentially a competitor of where they used to work. And if this is a successful company with a name that people recognize, at least in the area, having this shorter name could be one of the first steps you take in this employee leaving and starting their own company. I'm not sure what the business is. It says this person was an IT manager, so I don't know if they would even have enough information to do that, but it's just that's something that popped in my head right away was that's what I was thinking was happening because I don't know. I mean, I can see other reasons for why the person would buy the domain name, but it's just I guess I thought negative from the outset, but.
Well, that's fair. As attorneys, it's okay for us to be conservative, but let's think about this. From the positive end, he could have just did it because he was helping the company out. You know, he's an IT manager. He knows that having alternative domain names for your company might be beneficial down the line. But you're right, though. I think understanding his motivation is important how you deal with it. If you know for a fact, or even have a good inclination that he's planning on using this against you later on, then okay, maybe approaching this in a gentle way is not the best thing. So that's a very good point. But if you have in the concept that maybe he was doing it for the sake of the company, even better. But I think the approach may be the same. What I think is a good suggestion is, what if you send him a letter And also you can follow this up verbally with a check. And this check is in the amount of the cost for registering the domain name. And basically you tell them, oh, you know, thank you very much for registering this domain name for us. Since we're using this now for our email addresses, we wanted to make sure that you were reimbursed for this. And here's the amount of the check. And also, if you can kindly transfer the name into our name as soon as you get a chance. And hopefully he does it and you follow up. And then as soon as he does it, then you fire him. Okay. Well, if you want to get rid of him. But if he doesn't give it up, then right away, you know how he's planning on dealing with this.
Right.
And then before you let them go, you can deal with them a little bit more aggressively.
I think that's a good approach. And you could figure out pretty much right away the intentions behind getting that domain name just by how they would respond to your questions or suggestions on how to proceed with this.
It seems like employers are always in this position where usually employers know long before they're going to fire somebody before they make that decision. And there's always this weird period where they're trying to figure out when's the right time because they're worried about blowback and so forth. And it's the employers that don't concern themselves with this aspect that ends up getting them into trouble. Again, a corporate culture. If you are ready to fire somebody overnight or in a split second, assuming that it's not something egregious, then you're going to get into trouble or some kind of blowback from your employee.
Yeah.
All right. Law Dingo. What do we got with this next article?
Law Dingo. So this is a company. How I came across this was they actually were, and I guess they did it successfully because I came across it. They were trying to make a viral video gaining publicity. And you can watch the video. It's just on their website, Law Dingo, or if you search them in YouTube. Basically, the thing here is this emerging idea of lawyer directories. Now, obviously, a lot of people, I don't know what the statistics are, but a lot of people search for anything online, but attorneys are one of the things people search for. And all these companies are building directories of lawyers. How this one works is it has a couple boxes. It has what are you looking to do legally, and then what's your area, hit search, and a bunch of lawyers pop up with random facts about them. And at that point, I guess the customer just picks one at random or picks the first one. I don't know the thought process behind it. That's what I wanted to kind of get into with after watching this video was the concept of attorney directories. What's your take on those?
I think they're glorified yellow pages because I haven't looked into this company in detail, but I assume they work like other ones where the law firm or attorney pays to be on the directory somehow. I mean, I noticed that there's some kind of membership. I assume it's not free, or at least to make it worthwhile, it's not free. Do you still get calls from the Yellow Pages or emails asking you to advertise with them?
Yeah, occasionally. Not as frequently as the beginning, but yeah, it still pops up. It's actually funny, was my wife, when I was trying to figure out how I wanted to market myself online, she's like, well, people still use Yellow Pages. I was like, well, I was like, maybe not the actual, like, we have a huge stack of phone books in our complex downstairs that anyone can grab it. I don't think anyone has because no one cares to like actually look at the book. I know, I realize they have online presence too, but I don't know. The days of Yellow Pages, the actual brand, it was a lot better back before the internet, obviously.
Yeah, I think the best use of Yellow Page books are making YouTube videos and showing how you can rip them in half.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
That is true.
But other than that, I'm not sure. And I agree with these directory sites are somewhat new for in the legal end, but they've been around for a while in the sense that you have other websites. I don't know if I can name them all, but there's Fine Law, there's Law Info that you pay into a directory and you can get to. It's one way for attorneys to get themselves out there because, you know, when you're starting out, you need to get that publicity and so forth, that attention. So I guess it fills a gap.
Right.
Again, not for everyone, like most stuff. So I didn't actually watch the video, but looking at the comments of the article about it, I thought it was interesting that someone was saying that the comments on the YouTube video were fake because, you know, they were trying to make this a viral video. And apparently there was a lot of them that were, the accounts were created on the same day and all from Vietnam. Now, I don't know if it's true or not, but not surprising if they're trying to make it a viral video, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what you would want to do, I guess. So like I said, I mean, I found the video, so they were successful in getting their name out there. I didn't look to see how many views they had.
Remember when we did Top 4 Legal for our firm, we did a photo contest, right?
Yeah.
And so we opened it to the public to vote on it. And then this one person who will remain nameless for now, somehow he was getting like 10, 50 times more votes than anyone else. And our tech guys sent us an email saying, hey, we're pretty sure that most of these votes are fake because they're all from Vietnam. By the way, we don't have any clients in Vietnam that I know of or any context there. And they all came in within an hour of each other. So somehow they were manipulating it or whatever. And all the accounts, they looked like bot accounts or whatever. But, you know, we were giving away a free iPad, which we ended up not giving to them. That's what it reminds me of.
Yeah, I completely forgot about that. Plus, you just alienated all of our Vietnam audience. But
well, that's true. But we still like the Vietnamese. It's just that their computers over there are obviously controlled by those that like to spam or manipulate contests.
Yeah, they love commenting on YouTube videos and voting for things, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just their corporate culture.
All right. Next question. So this is from a serial entrepreneur from San Diego. Question, what is better, purchasing a business or starting from scratch? The process is what makes it fun. This is a pretty good question. Obviously, it's really difficult to answer this because I think it's pretty subjective.
Yeah.
Purchasing a business versus starting from scratch. I think it's going to depend on the individual and kind of what they want to achieve. What do you think?
Well, they say that people don't like purchasing a business because then the value that you're paying for, a lot of it is in the goodwill.
Right.
And people don't like paying for goodwill. It's always very subjective. Now, if you're buying assets and so forth, that's a different issue. But I think you're right. It depends upon who's buying it and why. We just did, I'll have to make some of the details generic, because we just did an acquisition of a company that was similar to our clients. And the target company, they had a lot of the assets that they didn't have to recreate or redo. If our client wanted to expand in that particular area, they'd have to buy all the equipment from scratch. They'd have to find the location. They'd have to hire new employees. Instead, they just found an owner that was retiring, that was in a certain position to sell. And they bought assets that were used. They just took over the lease and they retrained the employees. And it worked well for them. By the way, they didn't take over the company. We did an asset purchase. And just to clarify what that means is most of the time you don't want to buy the company itself because then you take on their liabilities. You usually just want to take on their assets and get all the contracts reassigned to you, your entity.
Right.
So for them, it worked out well.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if this person is a serial entrepreneur, they're definitely going to like the starting from scratch as opposed to purchasing a business.
That's true.
I mean, the people that really like, if they have an idea and they really want to see it out and enjoy all the good and the bad it is from starting a business, they're going to definitely want to start from scratch. But there's different people that would want to purchase a business too. I mean, you have, you know, immediate income as opposed to starting out. It's going to be pretty difficult to, I guess I should say, you should have immediate income or probably will, as opposed to starting out when you're going to be in the red a little bit for at least some period of time.
But what about financing, right? Because it's hard to get financing in general. But if you have an established business in our scenario here, and instead of starting from scratch and buying an old business, because of that has that history, you may be able to convince the bank to use that target company's books to help justify you in getting that purchase finance as well.
Yeah, that's true.
By the way, this guy says he's a serial entrepreneur. And if that's the case, then I bet you, because he's asking this question, I bet you he's never purchased a business. He's always worked from scratch. And I think even though he likes the process, just because you're buying a business and with its assets, as far as the work that's needed, there's still quite a bit of work because assumingly you are purchasing a distressed business. Otherwise, if you're really buying a successful business, then it's probably too expensive. And so if you're going to get a good deal, there's probably a lot of work for you to do still, you know?
So what's your answer? You have to answer one way or the other, purchased or start.
What is better? I would say, I think purchasing a business for a good deal, that's always better because you have the infrastructure there. And assuming you know how to run a business, you're going to be successful with that. One other thing too, is that starting from scratch may be less risky because that's wrong too, because when you're purchasing a business, you also have assets that you can always resell. When you're starting from scratch, you have to put in a lot of money up front, which I think is more risky because then you may not be able to recoup that in the long run.
All right, there you have it. That's the answer. Purchase a business. Everybody listening, stop starting businesses, but then there will be no more businesses to purchase either. So
that's true. Well, what do you say? What's your answer? I answered both, apparently, I think.
Like I said at the beginning, I think it's subjective. Me personally, I'd rather start from scratch just because I enjoy all the learning curve and all the excitement at the beginning. Plus, you can do things 100% your way. If you purchase a business, some things you won't be able to change, or at least won't be able to change easily.
Yeah.
Which, it's good and bad, but I personally would like to start from scratch, even though I have a less chance of succeeding. That's just my personality.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. All right, so next we have, the article says, more independent contractors are organizing. Meet Teamster taxi cabs. And this is from Business Week. It looks like in DC, these taxi cab drivers are basically creating an association. Now, taxi cab drivers have typically been in a union as employees, but since most of them have been converted to independent contractors, you know, they lease their own car, they buy their own medallion, or they lease that, then they're classified as ICs. So it looks like they're trying to gain some of the advantages back that they've lost as being independent contractors by forming this association.
I just never had really thought about it before. It seems I don't take taxis too often, but nowadays I've noticed that it seems like everyone has a different type of car and they're all named something. So it does look like it's more of, I would assume, an independent contractor basis if they have their own individualized things. I don't want to get into our last question here yet, but this is kind of bleeding into it. Why do you think that these cab drivers are doing this?
I wasn't aware that they used to be employees, but apparently there was a big trend to move them to independent contractors, which is not surprising because these employers want to get out of payroll taxes and worker benefits. But I think the reason they want to start forming a semi-union basically is for negotiation power, because each of these independent contractors, they technically, I bet you, still have an employer in the sense that they are leasing the cars from their ex-employer. Let's say you have a taxi cab driver that just converted. I bet you their old employer is the same company that they lease their car from, the same company that they pay for to do their dispatching. And so they still have that relationship, but it's just different now because it's independent contractor. But because they're independent contractor, they don't have some of those protections that they may have had as an employee. So now they need negotiation power.
The article mentions, too, some of these more startup companies like Uber and Lyft. Have you ever used these or heard of these?
You know, I know a lot of people that use these apps to find taxi cabs, right? I've never used them myself, though.
I use Uber occasionally.
What's Uber?
You can request a black town car. I think that's their main form, but now they have this Uber X, which is essentially, and this is the same thing Lyft is, it's just random people that'll pick you up.
What?
And drive you to where you need to be. I knew that was Lyft, but I guess Uber X is the same thing. My wife and I were going somewhere, this is maybe like a month ago. I was like, oh, I'll do Uber X because it's cheaper. I just assumed it was a taxi cab and not the town car. And this
okay.
This lady picks us up, and we're like, oh, okay. This is weird. And then she instantly tries to turn the wrong way down a one way, like right next to where we live.
Oh, no.
I was just like, you can't go left there. She's like, oh, yeah, I knew that. I knew that. I was like, well.
Yeah, Uber told me that.
Yeah.
I knew that.
It's like, well, you didn't because I had to tell you as you were turning the wrong way. It's, I don't know. That's a whole nother debate because this is what Lyft is. I couldn't take it. I just wouldn't ever be able to take because I don't trust random people driving me around. At least cab drivers have, you know, some sort of license, I would think.
Yeah.
Getting a little bit off topic, but I just had to say that.
That's pretty interesting because those are probably all independent contractors.
Right.
And when you form an association, it also creates standards. And you'll notice that all the taxi cab drivers say on the tagline, Teamster taxi cabs. And so even though they're independent contractors, if you, as a taxi cab passenger, if you see that Teamster taxi cabs, you'll know, okay, these guys are part of an association. So maybe they've developed some kind of standards on how they operate. They don't just let anyone into the association. Maybe they have to be driving for a certain amount of time. They know whether or not to turn into a one way or not. That should be a fundamental question that they ask right away. So yeah, I can see some benefits there.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to get into the third question we have here because, like I said, it blends into that article. This is actually something that someone just asked me yesterday here in San Diego, but it's a question that I get.
Oh, gosh, this question.
Yeah.
We get this like every day, right? But we got to cover it.
It's a top five asked question that I get. When is someone an employee versus when are they an independent contractor? I was asked to summarize this in a sentence or two, which is basically impossible.
Yeah.
What I always say first is it's all about control. That's the most important part. Different agencies have different tests I don't know what the IRS test is up to now, but I know it was, like 17 factors at one point or something around there.
I think IRS has 10, right?
10? Okay.
I think so, if I recall. But the problem is when lawyers analyze this, it doesn't really matter because you have the state of California that has a different analysis. You have the Workers' Compensation Board has a different analysis. So we really have to combine it all.
Right.
And I think if you combine all the factors, if you want to be thorough, there's probably like 20, 25 different aspects of it. And it's not something you can just check off either, too, because some factors are more important than others.
Right. How do you go about answering this? Because it's very difficult to answer it.
Well, we've done it in a couple ways. If you recall, like sometimes we had that factor list that we just go through one by one. Sometimes they're looking for an opinion letter. And so we'll do it that way. But whenever someone asks me that question, especially if it's specific, I hold myself to answer right away because it's a question which we have to be very careful in how we answer. Because let's understand the consequences, right? If you misclassify an employee as an independent contractor, then you have all these issues with payroll taxes, benefits to labor law violations of overtime, lunch breaks, and also vicarious liability, which means as an employee, you're generally responsible for what they do
right.
If they're in the scope of employment. But a contractor has less liability in general. So if they do something while on the job, you may or may not be responsible. And it kind of depends upon the circumstances.
Right.
So the consequences are pretty grave.
Yeah. And the thing is, even when someone asks us this, even if they give us a pretty detailed explanation of the relationship, even then it's still difficult to answer one way or the other. You're not going to know all the facts unless you actually sit down with them. I mean, obviously with our clients themselves, we sit down with them, go over everything so we make sure that we're advising them the right way. I'm just talking about the people that casually ask. And they'll just bring it up too, very casually, like, oh, like, so when is someone an employee and when is someone an independent contractor?
Is it weird how it's always an afterthought? It's like, okay, I have all these employees that I've classified as independent contractors, right? And I think the problem is too, is that there's such a trend in all these industries, like real estate agents, everyone tries to get them as ICs, hair salons, everyone tries to get them as ICs, and everyone just sees like, oh yeah, I'm an independent contractor. And so people see what other people do and they think it's fine. But what's crazy is that let's say that you terminate the contract, so to speak, of an independent contractor, and that contractor goes to the unemployment office and they say, oh, I'm here to collect unemployment. And they'll tell them, you're not an employee. And they'll say, yes, I am. And I did this, this, and that. That office may actually report the employer or give note to that ex-independent contractor to go to a lawyer and say, hey, I think I've been misclassified.
Yeah.
So it happens all the time.
It's a tricky situation. Like I said, it's not something you can easily answer. The ramifications of the misclassification are so severe there. They can be that business owners really need to get this squared away because it's something that could be fine at the beginning, or at least you think it's fine, and it's going to rear its ugly head down the road. And it's better to attack it at the beginning than have it come pop up later. And then you're sitting there in a bad position. And another thing that I just thought of in terms of the independent contractor side, the actual contractor themselves. And the reason I thought this is because I do a lot of tax work, is they get their 1099. There's typically no withholdings taken from these, from the amount they're paid. So there's no taxes taken out. As an independent contractor, you have to pay both sides of those payroll taxes. So self-employment, you're paying both sides. When you're filing your taxes, you calculate your tax out, and then you have this additional huge percent that you have to, you know, not huge, but what is it, like 15.3, whatever it is, something around there, it changes, but
yeah,
that they aren't expecting to pay. And that's how people end up owing money to the IRS and to the state.
Yeah.
They don't even think about that. A good decision for the business would be to let them know, hopefully in an agreement, saying, you know, you're the contractor, are responsible for paying all your taxes. You know, we're not withholding anything. Blah, blah, blah. But even then, the contractor, if they're not well-versed in taxes, which a lot of people aren't, then they're going to have a nice little surprise here come April 15th or October 15th if they file for extension.
Yeah, I don't want to drag this question out longer, but you're absolutely right that for whatever reason, employees want to be independent contractor status because they get a bigger check every 2 weeks or month, whatever they get paid. And so that's part of the problem as well. And even these taxi cab drivers from the previous article, they want to be independent contractors, a lot of them, but it may not be in their best interest.
And this is just coming down to people not even knowing about withholdings and tax. That's its whole other subject, but
yeah,
we'll get into that in another episode, exclusively tax issues that no one wants to listen to.
I'm so glad we covered this issue, only because I don't want to ever cover it again, this question at least, because we get this so often. Anyway, well, we'll probably end up covering it again because it is an important topic, but we do get it a lot.
Someone will send in a question with like a couple more sentences. Is this person an employee or are they an independent contractor?
Yeah.
It'll pop up again.
By the way, most of the time the answer is an employee. If they're on the cusp, then I would just classify them as an employee just to be safe, to be conservative. Yeah. Okay, well, that's the end of episode 3. Very exciting. And this is Legally Sound Smart Business. Don't forget to keep sending in your questions. We really appreciate you guys listening and participating in the show. That email address is ask@legallysoundsmartbusiness.com. Also, don't forget to rate us on iTunes too as well.
If you rate us on iTunes, we will give you a nice little shout out.
I don't even know how to access that, but I'm sure we can figure out a way to shout you out. Shout out. So, all right, guys.
All right.
Have a good week, and I'll see you next week.
Bye.
This has been the Legally Sound Smart Business Show with your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub. The Legally Sound Smart Business Show is your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Legally Sound Smart Business is a podcast that is intended but not promised or guaranteed to be current, complete, or up to date, and should in no way be taken as an indication of future results. No attorney-client relationship is created by listening or submitting questions to the podcast. The podcast does not constitute legal advice, but rather is offered only for general informational and educational purposes. You should not act or rely on any information in the podcast without first seeking the advice of an attorney. The opinions expressed in the podcast reflect the views of those individuals and do not necessarily represent the views of any other individual or business. For more information about the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, visit LegallySoundSmartBusiness.com.